Thank you so much. I think the library will always deserve my deepest appreciation for making this event possible. They're very well organized. They told me something that I've already violated, that if I step across this line, the light will fall on my head and I'll look prematurely ascendant. I can't do that. I get excited, and forgive me, but they are that particular and that excellent at organizing these events. And I have to thank Howard Brick, who you heard from, who has literally spent more time on this week than he could possibly spend on his classes, to my embarrassment, and is, as we go through this this week, he is also somehow consulting graduate students on the failed economy of the Roman Empire, if I understand that. And he's reading an entire book on the subject while he's at work. And his help has been really, really indispensable. And to the university, my thanks for their graciousness in accepting this collection. And let me just say a word about what this really means in terms of unfolding. For the next 4 or 5 years, I'll be here once a year for several days. I met today with 15 students, graduate, undergraduates, who I hope to enlist in a common effort to understand what's in these 125 boxes of history. We covered two or three small folders today. Somebody from the radio said, you're supposed to give these when you're dead, not when you're alive. Why are you doing that? And I said, well, you never know. But there's a reason. The reason is that if you try to go through 25 notebooks written rapidly in my handwriting, interviewing officials of Vietnam or this or that government, there's no possible way that some future student or graduate student will be able to read clearly. As an old Michigan Daily editor, I always like to make sure there are no corrections that have to be apologized for. So I'm actually reading through, and it's very emotional, some of it, very, very emotional. And I'm trying to get it articulated and in a way that the scholars and the students will be able to understand what's in there. There are precious things in there in the sense that university people will understand what we call primary sources, very small pieces of information that may seem unimportant to some people, but fit into the jigsaw puzzle of life that we are trying to understand and write about. And if you lose those pieces, as Muir said of the environment, you lose everything. The pieces are the whole when they're assembled. And so there's a lot of pieces there, and it's going to take a lot of work over the years. It's kind of a living library or living archive. So tonight, because of the coming climate demonstrations at the United Nations, which I will attend next week, I thought that there would be an opportunity to talk about the climate crisis and the role of the states and universities in that. It's a topic of deep significance for me. I was Governor Brown's solar energy advisor 40 years ago in the first Jerry Brown years, and I'm an informal Jerry Brown advisor now because I don't want anybody attributing to him what I'm about to say to you. But we try to work closely towards California forging a clean energy economy that can set a model for the country and for the Obama administration, and make a bid to leadership globally at the coming United Nations talk. So that's tonight. You know also that I'm an old anti-war activist from the Vietnam era. There are 25 or 50 boxes of FBI and CIA files that have been given to the university that prove that I was an anti-war activist. This is the 50th anniversary of the teach-ins, which I attended here briefly on that night in Angel Hall. And it will be a pleasure to engage with you and to speak on the same spot where those teach-ins were held and try to communicate the lessons of the Vietnam War applied to the Iraq War, version 1, version 2, version 3, which is an ordeal, but it's one where we learn that mistakes repeated again and again yield no better results than the first time. And what's extraordinary is the similarities between the arguments that Carl Oglesby and other students gave at the University of Michigan against the war in Vietnam. And amazing that young people who had almost no experience and were learning on our own knew so much more than the State Department, PhDs, the Pentagon, and the CIA officials, and how this repeats. So that will be a very moving occasion for me, and I'm hard at work at trying to, again, share with you some of the materials from the archives. But this film is a coming together of Jane Fonda and Tom Hayden one more time here in Ann Arbor. It was shot 40 years ago. It took about a year to assemble. The war ended, and so the film lost its audience, and it went into the basement archive somewhere. It was shot by a prize-winning filmmaker, Haskell Wexler, over a three-week period in Vietnam. It's called Introduction to the Enemy, the idea being that when I first learned of Vietnam, I learned that I couldn't go there, that it was forbidden, that it was illegal, that reporters couldn't go there, that no one could know except the CIA and State Department who would tell us where Vietnam was. I learned that it was on Johnson's stomach from a famous cartoon. But we knew nothing. And I was surprised last year to find this film. I talked to Haskell and to Jane. Haskell is 90. If this film has any great impact on you, it will be because he is a tremendous cinematographer, and he's dealing with live realities. A person, while we're filming, is killed by an American bomb in front of our eyes. He keeps the camera rolling. He's crying. This is an incredibly shot movie, given the fact that there's no budget and no team. Jane and I are the team, but we're also the actors, we're the interviewers. And yet, there was something important enough about the whole experience that he was able to achieve a film from the chaos of running around up and down every day and so on. So it's, I think, for that reason alone, it's well worth watching. But I'm afraid that the message of the film is compelling for today. The Obama administration is spending millions of dollars on a multi-year campaign to narrate an official version of Vietnam that can't even acknowledge whether it was a mistake and includes no voices from the critics, no reference to the teach-ins, no reference to the draft resistance. So in this exercise in state reconstruction of history, we see the problem of how history repeats unless all of the pieces are put together, unless all of the people, including the dissenters, the resistors, are included, so that a later generation can evaluate who was right, who was wrong, how did it really turn out. So that's Wednesday night. Now, tomorrow, I'm speaking at 2:30 in Matthew Countryman's class on the 60s, and that's open to the public and has been announced. But the purpose of that lecture and exchange with the students is to discuss the early years of SDS, which was born here in Ann Arbor, and the early years of the 60s with SDS and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Kennedy administration, the Peace Corps, leading up to the assassination of President Kennedy, whom I watched that deadly atrocity from a room here in Ann Arbor, and over and over and over. And so the 60s becomes a vast category. I don't remember anyone in the 60s saying, hey, we're in the 60s. Never happened. It's not a bad category, but you have to remember it's an attempt by someone to capture what did happen. And what did happen started in the 50s and ended in the 70s. It was not just the 60s. And it had stages. And what happened in Ann Arbor was like the birth of a social movement. And how that happens needs to be discussed. What also happened later in Ann Arbor, the growth of the resistance and then the Weather Underground, and then the escalation of the militancy also has to be understood from a historical standpoint. It all has some roots in Ann Arbor. It all unfolded stage after stage in Ann Arbor. And so that's an important task for me, or challenge. I'm thinking about how to deal with it in a two and a half hour classroom setting with people who were not only not alive then, but their parents, in most cases, were not alive then, and see things through Occupy, or they see things through their current generational framework. And I believe that's it. The ceremony where the papers are officially accepted is Thursday. You don't have to come to that. I thought they called it an ascension. And I thought, as an old Catholic, that was pretty funny. But really, it's called an accession. My papers are being accessed to future generations. So I'm really glad that I got that straight before. I had another outfit I was going to bring if it was an ascension. It's true. I did. Because I'm a child of the Shrine of the Little Flower Church and Father Coughlin, so I know about the devil. I know about ascensions. For tonight, let me try to do this. It's complicated to give a live presentation while hoping that the pictures behind my shoulder are loosely coordinated. The first step, I believe, is to ask for the lights to be dimmed. Is that fair enough? And then we have action. At least, yeah, some of the lights. That's fine. Can you see all right? Are you good? You sure? All right. Well, I call this presentation Reinventing Fire. It's the title of a book by a climate scientist and activist, Amory Lovins, who many of you may have heard about, who's been at it for years and is quite brilliant, and is in the genius class of the environmental thinkers. And And while, you know, he and I may have differences on this or that, the fundamental point he's trying to explain as what motivates him is he thinks this is as critical as when humans first struck fire and they experienced the power that could be wielded with fire. And he posits that we're at the long end of that age, that it's ending, and that a new source of fire, that is energy, has got to be developed to replace the earlier stages in human evolution. I grew up in Detroit. It was Highland Park, actually, and I shoveled coal as a little boy. That's what I did. That was my chore. My dad was a fixture in the automobile industry that was the center of industrial growth in the United States and the world. My mom and I, when my dad went into the Marines, my mom and I sat on the couch and watched as President Roosevelt reassured us that all would be well in our happy home in Detroit or later in Royal Oak. My chore was to shovel coal. The men would bring the coal every day. That was the house. That was the church when we moved to Royal Oak. I don't see the slide of the fire, so let me go back. You have to see what I, there it is. That was my furnace. And that was the glowing fire that I looked into every day of my young life. Fire is powerful. I didn't become a pyromaniac, but one could. I was just short of a fire worshiper. But fire is powerful. Fire is power. So that was how I grew up. And then when I went to the Shrine of the Little Flower, actually what Father Coughlin did for me was instill this extreme fear of eternal fire. Hell was like what I saw in the furnace. And if things didn't work out well for me, I would go into the furnace. And I knew what that would be like. So fire became a very important image in my life. Then in those days, no one told me. My dad came back from the Marines. We moved to Royal Oak. No one told me that Royal Oak was one of the first racially segregated suburbs to be built out of the economic growth and the affluence of Michigan. It took a graduate student many years later writing this book that obtained all the documents, all the racial covenants. All they told me in the school was that there were secrets I would learn later. So very early on, I became interested in investigating stuff. I was the editor of the high school paper, and the principal at the school told me there were secrets about Royal Oak that he couldn't share with me. Don't ever tell that to a kid. Don't ever say that. Or maybe he intended to. Maybe it was a drip left behind for me. I don't know. So what I'm saying is my early life was, I was very affected by coal, cars, the fossil fuel industry, but also the segregation of the races, which was occurring because there had been a riot or rebellion in 1943 in my city that my parents didn't tell me about and that I didn't see. And then there was the housing covenant, then there were the real estate deals, then there was the federal mortgage subsidies, and suddenly we were able to buy a house in Royal Oak that other people couldn't. And those people had to leave by sundown, unless they lived in a white person's house. So that, too, had a deep effect on me, and always has, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But the result was, for me, the need to battle climate change and environmental disaster and pollution, but also to reverse poverty, unemployment, and racism have always been one issue in my mind, floating around looking for integration or synthesis or combining. So I came to the University of Michigan, where I worked very, very hard as a student, as you can see. That's Frank Joyce from Royal Oak, who I think is also sleeping, but he's more clever at appearing to be awake to his professor. I just was an all-out sleeper. That's it. Don't ever grow up like me. See that? Don't ever. In those days, 1957, it was $100 a semester. It was a different world, utterly and totally different, despite the patterns that are universal, utterly and totally different on the level of life as it's lived. Students today cannot comprehend that going to a university for free was, it's just not possible for them to absorb that idea. That's a problem in teaching. It was also the year of the Beat Generation. I don't think you remember that On the Road was a book that everybody read, and I hitchhiked everywhere. I hitchhiked to the South. I was Jack Kerouac. I thought that was great writing, and it had to be simply because he had a way, along with Salinger and some other writers, to channel what I was already feeling, but I'd never put into words. It was also the year of Little Rock, school desegregation. Can you begin to remember that a Republican president of the United States sent troops, not into South Vietnam, but into Little Rock, Arkansas, to force the desegregation of schools? That actually happened. I had a picture of it. I could not understand it. It just kind of went by me. And it was recorded as something big that had happened. But I didn't have a way to apply it to Royal Oak or to my Michigan experience. I was just learning. But I didn't know much about the environment. I knew about coal. I didn't know about pollution. When I went to university, Rachel Carson had not published Silent Spring. You had to be really a deep ecologist to go back to the environmental wisdom of the 19th century or Aldo Leopold around the Midwest. You had to go way back. It wasn't there. How quickly we lose it. But it just wasn't there. But what did affect me, I was at the editor. I was doing my best. I'm photographed concealing my subversive unconscious, trying to fit in, that was knocked out of me, wearing the same suit, just a short time afterwards. I was drawn to Mississippi because I was in love with people in the civil rights movement that I'd met. They were not from Michigan. Of course, they were right down the street, but it had to be people coming from Mississippi that finally attracted my attention. And they were students. And they communicated a message that the university couldn't, which was an old moral question. Is there anything that you would die for? Is there anything that you would die for? And it turned out that was the most important question in my life and for thousands and perhaps millions of other people. And I met people who were willing to die. They weren't trying to die. They didn't consider themselves martyrs, but some of them were being killed. And they were going back. And I went to the Kennedy administration, and I talked to the Attorney General for Civil Rights, and I said, you've got to do something. And he said, the best thing you can do, Mr. Hayden, is tell your friends in SNCC to leave Mississippi because we can't help them. And that was liberalism at its best, trying to do the humane thing, help these youngsters from being beat up, killed. But he was also saying, we're the Justice Department, and the Constitution of the United States cannot be enforced in Mississippi. There are whole parts of the United States that are another country operating according to their laws and procedures. My advice is get out. Second thing, you don't tell kids to get out of adventures and dangerous situations. So I went back in. And then they really tried to get me out. This fellow beat me up while I was writing for The Nation magazine in Macomb, Mississippi. And then they took me and interrogated me with Paul Potter, also from Ann Arbor, who was vice president of the National Student Association. And they said we could either go to jail or leave the state. So not having quite come to the full courage of my manhood, I said, where's the airport? And and we left. We went and talked to the FBI, and we learned that this was a repetitive pattern. As a matter of fact, the black people in SNCC, who were my friends, said, said it was a good thing, Tom, they're speaking a southern accent, it was a good thing, Tom, that you got whooped. We would have been killed, that's the first point. You only got whooped, but you got your picture in the paper. And we don't get our picture in the paper, so it's useful. That was said to me by Julian Bond and Charles McDue of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I was a willing pawn in their strategy because I was young and completely full of myself. And then I went from there. I had been deeply transformed. I went to Newark, came back here briefly for graduate work, went to Newark to carry out a community organizing strategy in the slums. It was SDS inspired. The plan was written here in Ann Arbor. We randomly chose cities to go to. I had never been to Newark, New Jersey, and I willingly went because somebody said that's a good spot to go. And it was. And I would have been living there now if it was not for the burning down of the city and the destruction of Vietnam. But I went. And I learned what I couldn't learn at the university, but I wouldn't have been there without the university. I learned that listening to people, you get a subjectivity, you get a voice, you get a sense of the world that has to be integrated with yours. Otherwise, you are a do-gooder, or you are absent from the whole deal. And the fundamental premise, which really stunned me, was that poor people have brains. They're probably better at surviving than anybody in this room, for all I know. It's a certain kind of intelligence. And if you don't get that, they understand what they're discussing and whether it's going too far or it doesn't go far enough. They're good. They have a good, they're good judgment about survival and about whether one can make a little progress or not. And that was a profound learning experience I'll return to. It ended in the burning of Newark. I wrote about that for the New York Review of Books, and Random House brought out a book. This was a book where, again, it was based more on listening than anything else. The idea was to tell the story of how 26 people died and what the police version was and what the community version was. The response to that was that the CIA adopted this book for its counterintelligence programs as a mapping out of how revolutions occur, that their national security forces should be aware of. This was like a blueprint for how revolution happens. The grand jury tried to put me in jail for not divulging the sources, the eyewitnesses, because I thought that was unconstitutional, and there was no reason to believe that the police would ever investigate who really was behind the killing, and they didn't. I was justified, and I somehow escaped prison for that. Then a week later, it happened in Detroit, my hometown. So I was prepared for Detroit. I got prepared by Watts in 65. And everybody I knew in Newark kept discussing every day, when's it going to come here? It was like a concert tour or a military juggernaut. Destiny is going to come. It's going to come to every city. We don't even study today how many cities burned down. I calculate 150, but there are different accounts. And the destruction was immense. The consequences much greater and much more far-reaching than I had ever realized. I was in these scenes when I was 27 years old, 28 years old. Then the Vietnam War exploded. 1965, President Johnson said, won't send any American ground troops. By the end of 1965, 130,000 young American men drafted. Existential crisis. Never heard of the place. Why should I fight there? My dad wants me to fight there. What's the reason? What are my friends doing? It blew apart our generation. The thing we all have in common that we know is that we were all lied to on multiple occasions. We were never told why, how, what. It was unwinnable, unaffordable. Oh, no, it's a cheap war. It'll be brief. And fire again. The fire from the furnace came back at me. I went to North Vietnam and to the demilitarized zone, to Cambodia, to Laos, 6, 7, 8 times, probably 2, 3 months of my life. And I interviewed people on the ground. And I began to understand the ecological unfolding. The burning of fossil fuels from America in military vehicles from Detroit being used to set fire to jungles, to villages, and to towns, spewing herbicides, Agent Orange, from Michigan into those places with lasting effects to this day. If you go back, you meet all kinds of young people at Agent Orange conferences who have flappers instead of arms, who don't have legs, who still demand their rights as disabled people from the Vietnamese government, from the Western powers. Fire went on and on and on. Everything seemed to always be burning down. And this is one of the reasons that people of my generation turned to violence or became indifferent to violence, because we lived in fire. When it ended in a disaster, and it ended in the fall of Nixon, a good thing. But it could have been handled differently. It didn't. But it also gave rise to Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown became governor at age 34. That's the day of his election day. I don't know what I was. I was 32, something like that. And we had bonded over our shared experience of the 60s, although he was quite different, safer. But he was a very deep philosophical person who was interested in religion, spirituality, philosophy, the meaning of things. And he had a special interest in Buddhism and existentialism and how to replace fire. So I became his solar energy advisor. Here we are all dressed up. That's my three-piece suit that somebody from Hollywood bought me because they thought I would look better. And that's his tie. He once told me that if you wear ties with those dots, it projects power on television. So those of you who are trying to impress audiences or women or other men, wear a tie with the dots is clearly the way to go. It made the difference in the election. So I got I got caught up in the insanity of electoral politics at the same time that I was caught up in solar energy. He became known as Governor Moonbeam because he occasionally let people take pictures of him, like this one, where he's playing around with a tiny, tiny windmill that's powered by solar. You know, a toy. But that's what people thought of solar. They thought it was a toy. And that's what they thought of Jerry Brown. He was a kid who was clearly from another planet. They called him Moonbeam. They don't call him that anymore. I don't know quite where those people went. He appointed me the head of the solar energy program for California. That was part of a federal solar energy program. And so I was part of the Western representation to the federal program, which brought me to meetings with President Carter, who put solar collectors on his roof. And we actually saw federal officials announce that it was realistic to reach a solar society in less than 50 years, even sooner. That was the late 1970s. So here we are tonight, Ann Arbor. I'm not trying to convey to you that things go in an eternal circle. I think, really, things build off an invisible past. Invisible because some people don't want you to know the past. Invisible because of denial. Invisible because we ourselves don't put our archives in the university library for other people to discover. So today, what I'm involved in is building, this is only my language, a green power block. In 2009, the governor sent an email to several friends asking what should be done about these charts that he had from the Central Intelligence Agency. Shouldn't we do something about this if these were true? Drought. Fire. Flood. War. Drought, fire, flood, war. That was the future of the world if the intelligence reports were accurate. And as governor and a longtime solar advocate, he wanted to commit himself to one more effort, one more struggle to do something about this if there was even a reasonable chance that these projections were true. I could not have agreed more with him. So what I've been working on is the development of a clean energy model based in California with California characteristics, but one that is exportable elsewhere through alliances, not through imposing it on other countries or states, but through alliances. Briefly, the clean energy economy in California includes the laws that we passed 20 or 30 years ago on tailpipe emissions that took decades before they became the federal standards. We had to fight Detroit for 20 or 30 years. The automakers were saying Detroit would come to an end if we went the way of California. Everybody was berating Governor Brown, seeing people in California were like lunatics and so on. They're not making those jokes anymore. We're first in clean air programs, first in fuel efficiency, first in green building design, and first in venture capital for investment in sustainable and renewable energy projects. We have saved 70, this is a minimum estimate, $70 to $100 billion to consumers over the past era, started with Jerry Brown, continued by Arnold Schwarzenegger, and renewed now by Jerry Brown. We have in California a minimum of 200,000 jobs in clean energy. Nothing in the fossil fuel sector compares to that, and this number is only growing. It can't shrink. Our renewable energy generation is 56% between 2002 and 2012, including the recession. And our electricity from solar grew three times more in the same period, 10-year period. And those statistics are just from 2 or 3 years ago. This is the just the schedule for the climate talks. I'm not here to tell you hope for a solution at the climate talks in France next year, but at least, for heaven's sake, know about it, because it's an opportunity for Michigan. There's a march this week in New York. There'll be 100,000 or 200,000 people. The UN will open on Tuesday with Ban Ki-moon announcing climate as the one-day opening agenda. 150 leaders from around the world will tell you what their clean energy goals are and whether they're consistent with what the climate scientists have said we have to do by 2050 or fall into irreversible climate catastrophe. After this election this November, the international talk shift to Lima, Peru, which I'll come back to, but the point is it's fundamental to dealing with climate change that we deal with justice. Third world country, lesser developed countries, poor countries have a majority of votes at the UN General Assembly. Among the top emitters, some of them are there too, like Mexico, our neighbor, California. So without their buying in, without their agreeing to a formula, there's no going forward. So those negotiations are crucial. Then it will really speed up, and you'll begin to hear about it probably before it's too long, because there'll be monthly rounds of negotiations aimed at an agreement in Paris or France somewhere a year from this November. And the scientists say that's our last chance at the idea of an enforceable international agreement. It won't be tried again. So every country, every region will be on its own, including Ann Arbor. The goal is climate stabilization, whatever that is, but you must all know these numbers, that it means at a minimum no greater than 2% Celsius or 3.6 Fahrenheit warming above pre-industrial levels. 15 countries now produce 70% of carbon emissions. They include South Africa, they include Mexico, they include Indonesia, India, China, and so on. Jeffrey Sachs, who's not the only expert, but he's the one that's preparing the document, concludes in his preliminary report that we are not anywhere on track to stay within the 2 degrees Celsius level. Not. But the goal is feasible. And December 2015 is our last chance to reach a negotiated agreement. Now, this green bloc I'm talking about in the United States only, including our Midwest, I calculate is 143 million people. By this, I'm careful to say we're talking about people that live in states where carbon reduction agreements have been reached on paper and begun their implementation. If you want to think green, think of something that's just barely beginning to grow from the ground. It's not full blown. It's also an area that has a total GDP of $6.4 trillion. And if you include Mexico and Canada, $8 trillion. So we're not talking about a marginal amount of people or resources. We're talking about nearly half the country, and you can guess which half. So we have a long way to go. This is Jerry Brown's most recent State of the Union speech, where you can see it says, many miles to go, Jerry Brown. He is 76, and he says we have many miles to go. He knows what he's talking about. He started when he was 34. So the block. On the West Coast, we have an action plan that's actually been signed between the following entities: California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. Okay? East Coast, New England, Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, signed on by Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, Rhode Island, Vermont, and New Jersey until Governor Christie removed it as a retaliation against the environmentalists. But you also have observers who have status, Pennsylvania, New Brunswick, Ontario, and Quebec. And Ontario will go green this year, I believe. I don't want to jinx it, but I'm pretty sure. So all of Canada will be part of this, except for Stephen Harper and his friends that are trying to do the shale excavation up in central Canada. The Midwest. I will never say that word again. I will, for now and evermore, call it the Great Lakes. But the slideshow is done. It can be changed tomorrow. So we have signatories, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Manitoba, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and observer status, Indiana, Ohio, Ontario, and South Dakota. I think we'll be moving Ontario into the upper column soon. I hope so. Okay, now you have Michigan. This is your standard tourist photo of the Great Lakes, which we hope to alter in future time. This you probably know about, that $1 billion a year leaves Michigan every year to elsewhere to buy that coal that I used to be able to shovel in my basement. Gone. Went to people like, oh, that's Cheney. went to Wyoming. Then there's a very good report that I'm sure you've all seen or heard of by the Union of Concerned Scientists, very progressive group, but scientifically sound. And their report on Michigan and the Great Lakes is interesting. So Michigan's renewable policy, which you probably know, it was 2008 under Governor Granholm, and the goal that was set was low. It was 10% from renewables by 2015. I remind you that's coming right around the corner, so that goal has to be achieved before moving forward. But the Union of Concerned Scientists say that it's entirely practical to gain 17.5% of electricity in Michigan from renewables by 2020, which is only the end of Jerry Brown's next term, and 32.5% by 2030, entirely feasible. If done, that would bring Michigan to a California level. Of course, by then, California would be hopefully at a higher level. This is a fruitful competition because the leading states have to keep leading to pull the center of gravity forward. And if you're on the other end of the train, you're pulling us backward. That would be Mississippi. The UCS report says Michigan has vast in-state renewable energy resources enough to generate annually several times the state's total electricity demand. Fact. Now, I'm a politician, so I know how hard it is to get from a paper goal to reality. But we have to try to keep in mind what the most knowledgeable people say is possible and then challenge to go farther without forgetting how each step is a huge struggle and there are setbacks. These are images of how it will be done in Michigan, as I'm sure you believe it can be done. We're talking about wind, offshore wind, onshore wind, solar collectors, bioenergy, but look who's ahead. Minnesota's up. We're in the last half. Minnesota's ahead. You can't go pointing at Ohio State because they're ahead too. But Minnesota, I wonder why. Could it have some political explanation? Minnesota leads the Great Lakes region. Now we come to the movement, and the new environmental movement led by students and young people, known as 350.com. It's interesting to me, having belonged to all the environmental organizations, that tens of millions goes to the big environmental groups, but the marching masses, the marching bands, are the young people who came sort of out of nowhere. And I know why, because it happened to me. It's an existential reaction to the cards you're dealt when you're 17. They're told downward mobility, worse jobs, and if that doesn't trouble you, higher education, unaffordable. And if that's not bad enough, the end of the world is going to happen anyway because of bad weather, extreme climate. It's over according to science. So thank God they do not join certain predictable organizational reactions to this kind of news to the young. But it doesn't surprise me that young people refuse to put up with it. Should it surprise anyone? It's a gift. It's the nature of life. They're not going to lie down. They're not going to take it. This was the Port Huron statement. This occurred in my life when I was 20. This was conceived here, or really in Mississippi, but it was argued here. And then we went to Port Huron to write a 25,000-page manifesto, which didn't even include much about the environment, just a single line. But it came out of the same inspiration. How else could you explain? People say, well, how the hell did you write it? I say, I don't know. After 50 years, my answer now is, it wrote us. This is University of Michigan student Sharon Jeffrey and Dickie Magadoff sitting on the grass here debating these far-off issues that would become the Port Huron Statement. Her mother was Mildred Jeffrey, who was a top official of the UAW. Many of you know her or loved and worked with her over the years. Sharon was one of the few at Port Huron who came from a very political, liberal labor family. Dickie Magadoff was from New York. He was there. Dick Flax, my closest friend at the university, was a graduate student in the sociology department, a couple years ahead of me, and one of the main authors of the Port Huron Statement. The central idea was that we had to replace the Cold War with some international development program and end racism in America, and they were intimately related, that the Cold War was in the way of justice in America. The Cold War was in the way of having the money we needed for unemployment to be resolved. And that's all we were. That's what we looked like. That's me with that Stalinist fist over there on the right. Always apart from the crowd. I don't know why. And a lot of those students are Ann Arbor students. The students today, this is an effort at solarizing, I believe that's the Ohio State Stadium, but it could be an effort in Ann Arbor soon enough. So that's why I think these students are animated and aroused about climate, because in a strange way, it has invaded their life just as seriously as the draft invaded my life. And I was being drafted into a real war. They are more sensitive to what's happening to their life as a result of this force that seems invisible to many of their parents and to half the country. They're calling for divestment here at the university, but also around the country. And they can make reference correctly to how impossible it seemed back in the effort over South Africa and over tobacco. But I was involved in those events, and I saw them over time come to fruition when everybody said it couldn't happen, it was irresponsible, you didn't understand economics, and so on. So what we have here is a question that, as old as Port Huron, whether the university should be conceived idealistically by its students, at least, as being a center where new ideas and activism could be generated and nurtured and sent forth to change the world. And I think that the university has started. It's officially endorsed sustainability as a mission of the university. You have 700 faculty and 600 courses here that touch on sustainability issues. You have begun to purchase wind energy to power the electrical system on the campus. Not to be competitive here, but the University of California just purchased enough solar power to offset 60% of its electricity in use at five campuses. And the Michigan effort is slow by some standards and better by other standards, like Dick Cheney's. But let's look at it glass half full. The challenge is only 2% of that energy from energy that the campus uses for electricity is coming from wind. Maybe 3%. I've had many debates. Is it 2% or 3%? But it's nonsense. 2% is a very low figure. And as the university, the concerned scientists say, it's easy to go far, far beyond 2% power generated by wind for the university. After all the sustainability efforts at the campus, gross overall emissions are up, have increased. I'm not talking about your per capita emissions, those of you who walked or rode your bicycle here. I'm talking about the Ann Arbor University of Michigan campus emissions are up after a decade of trying to drive them down. Not an easy task. And it's not like you have to feel isolated or freakish. 687 other university presidents have signed on to an agreement to lower their carbon standards and emissions in the direction of zero carbon sustainable campuses. Michigan has not signed that, and I'm here to appeal to you, to appeal to the university, to sign on to what 687 have done. And if that argument doesn't work, here's a better one. Stanford is in, where are you? You don't want to meet them in a Super Bowl, I mean in a Rose Bowl. You don't want to get into a tangle with Stanford. Over marching bands, fine. But Stanford is divesting from coal. And the resolution says, we are divesting now from coal, and we are now examining other fossil fuels for similar purposes. That's Stanford. You can look at this as from a gloomy perspective. I know that there were efforts made by the state's environmentalists to pass in 2012 a higher standard, and it was rejected. I know that DTE poured a lot of money into crushing it, but we get up from being crushed. And everybody in Ann Arbor will, in time, get up. And I hope you're led by the students and by the people from, people like the environmentalists I met this afternoon for several hours who have been at it for a very, very long time. The effort is, I think, possible. One of the possibilities is if the state is too high a hurdle, there's a movement underway, to make Ann Arbor itself an island of carbon-free energy, something like Oberlin in Antioch, Ohio. And the expansion, the approval of an expanded Ann Arbor Ypsilanti bus system was achieved by local environmentalists, by CLCV, by clergy, by social justice activists, and a regional transit system for Metro Detroit is under discussion. Which brings me to environmental justice and the question of Detroit. I said I shoveled coal. I grew up there. I am not a foreigner to the subject. I've been there many times in recent years. I spent hours there yesterday. But by way of prelude, let me say this. For California and for myself, the question of social and environmental justice is separate from environmentalism, but also interlocked, integrated, inescapably so. It's not a matter of morally telling you this, it's a matter of reality, that the issues are related. Our cap and trade law requires the reduction of emissions and offsets. In this case, we're lowering emissions in California and giving the industry a break on our pollution because they bought 100,000 acres in the Upper Peninsula to preserve for you. Did you know that? It's a strange program. But it's also our law that the goal is to reduce emissions, but you have to have a co-benefit. You have to reduce emissions in such a way that you attack the problem where it's the most severe, which is in the areas that are the most polluted. And it's a practical issue, political issue. A Times poll shows 50% of Latinos and 46% of Asian Americans in California personally worry a lot about global warming, while only 27% of whites worry. Well, let's get that up to 40. 27 is a low standard, right? It's a low bar. And these people in the front column are worse off economically than the people in the other column. Or the Koch brothers came to California. I understand they put in appearances in Michigan occasionally, secretly. And they tried to reverse our global warming law, which is the key to everything. And they put it on the ballot, and they put like $30 million into it. And it was defeated 62-38 in 2012. Defeated. Complete reverse of what happened in Michigan, because in our state, we had something to lose. We had this law, and they were trying to take it away. But people of color voted 73% against the Koch brothers, and whites voted 57%. So again, there's a gap, there's a disparity there. It seems to me that that makes the case for environmental justice as an integral political part of any environmental strategy. We have something that you might be able to get the university to do. We have a climate map. It's quite brilliant, and the government it's interesting. We're very proud of the fact that we've disclosed to people in our state where pollution is. It's unbelievable. They know, they don't tell you. But the environmentally conscious EPA and governor's office decided to map out by census tract the racial and economic and environmental patterns in California. And it shows, this is the center of California down at the bottom left there. That's Los Angeles County. That is majority people of color. And it is the most polluted city. It has the most polluted ports, no matter how many improvements have been made. It still stands. And then there's the Central Valley. It's agricultural California, where the pesticides flood into the water system. And that's Fresno, dead in the middle. You get up to Sacramento, you get a little. San Francisco less, and the other areas are so underpopulated that they can't be polluted easily, although people may be working on that. It's difficult. So what about Detroit? This is a fantasy image of the future of a rebuilt Detroit, right? You've seen all this. And some very good people are working to make that real. It's the agenda of many, many longtime environmentalists, many community activists, many community gardeners, progressive businesses, and the Kresge Foundation, and others, trying to map a plan that builds sustainability, that is environmental justice, into one conceptual foundation so that you don't redevelop a polluted city or underdevelop it. It's an intriguing idea. Whether it happens is up to you. These are all the places that I came from. It's a place I visited yesterday. This is an example of the many community gardens. Back to fantasy, this is our all-electric car made in Detroit. But to me, it has a funny resonance, this hypothetical electric car. Because when my dad was born and my mom was born, that was an electric car. Where did electricity go? Why did they get rid of it? It was a war, a class war, an energy war over the internal combustion engine, over gasoline, petroleum, fossil fuel, versus solar-based electricity. That's been going on a long time. So in a way, I'm returning to my roots. We're returning to our roots by going forward with a revolution against the fossil energy state. And in conclusion, I'll just tell you a little story that I find very moving. That's a spacecraft that's been traveling for 10 years. You can't see it. It's an image. It's gone 4 billion miles. Its name is Rosetta. It's named Rosetta because of the search for the meaning of the universe and where life came from that was explored in the hieroglyphics eons ago, the search for the Rosetta Stone. So the mission of the Rosetta spacecraft is to learn as much as possible about the origin of our sun, our solar system, and our universe, and transmit the information back to us. It's now successfully connected, just a minute away from a comet that it's chosen. Comets are like the debris of Earth. Somehow, somewhere, they broke away, and they're still out there. They're us, they're related, but what can we learn about them? What is that comet about? What is it doing? Does it think? Does it have a mission? And together, they're trying to understand the composition of the comet, and they're going to perish where it all began. They're going to perish in the sun and give us knowledge that we don't have of how the system came together 4.5 billion years ago. And it's all made possible by two 47-foot photovoltaic collectors that have been operating to make this story a story of the universe that we can understand. So don't tell me that we're not ready for solar energy. We should be praying and door knocking and politicking and organizing and screaming for its arrival. And we should be going at it with the same force that this spacecraft is heading towards its disappearance into the mystery of the sun and eternity. Thanks very, very much for your time. Al Haber. I was looking for you. Where are you?
Brother Tom, marvelous as ever. So I was a little late because we have our local struggle here on the Commons on how actually to get people together in public space to deal with peace, to deal with the climate crisis, all the questions before us. So that's one thing I want to say, that next Sunday, the International Day of Peace, while you're in New York at the Climate March here in Ann Arbor, there's an opportunity for people to gather, to put on the table the knowledge that we have and how to see how our community and movement grow. And we're going to be live streaming from New York if we can set that up, and the Climate March from there to here, because this is, as we all know, one movement of everybody, and we have to think together and move together. And that's really the question I want to put. How do you see, in the activist sense, like 350.org, where the students are, you know, coming demanding divestment from oil, that older people actually get into this? Because it seems very much hard to activate our own community. People come, beautiful to see, to hear, but when it comes to challenge of the power or to put into political candidacy people who will challenge, that is much more difficult. So give a little bit more on how we build the movement. And Ann Arbor next Sunday at the Library Commons, all come that, for
that's the subject
Peace
of
Day.
My remarks at the Matthew Countryman class just 13 hours from now. But I do think the young always lead, and they're the warm energy that should get us out of our frozen apathy and should listen carefully to what they're saying and try to use our adult or professional or community skills at helping them achieve some kind of progress. Things can go wrong, as we learn from our movement histories. If you watch from beginning to end, people can burn out. People can go crazy. I mean, literally, like, go mad. People can become way too apocalyptic. It's very hard to have a persistent presence if you feel under-supported or alone or ignored or not respected or not included. So simply the effort by the university community Ann Arbor to embrace the people trying to change Detroit and embrace the students who are trying to change the university for the better is kind of the first step. And then listening and bringing your multiple skills over many, many years to bear on how to push forces that seem to be irresistible into having to move. If anything I said tonight should be underscored, it's that this process is much slower, even if you work at passionate speed. It's much slower than I ever imagined it would take to achieve anything. So I've drawn the conclusion things move really, really, really slowly until they move really fast. And you have to stay in the river while it's moving really, really slowly, because the waterfalls will come, the rapids will come. But if you don't have your oar in the water and you don't know exactly, you don't know how to navigate, and you start holding meetings, what should we do now after it's all erupted, that's too late. So even the small things you're doing are a result of big things that happened before, and they're the precursor of big things that will happen again. Peter Eckstein.
I think this fellow's...
I just have to recognize...
Good to see you.
Important people. Yeah.
All right. Well, let me... So you talked about the recent transit expansion, the millage that passed. It was a coalition of environmental activists and economic justice activists. And I tend toward more the economic justice activism type of material work. And that's already under pressure. The agency has to file a Civil Rights Act document saying that they will not have differential service in minority routes. And they're already saying that there's a new phenomena in Washtenaw County where there are more black people and low-income people in Ypsilanti than there are in Ann Arbor. And they said this just happened in 2010. That's what they say. And at the same time, so I was just at a meeting where they're having this 100-page document that we're not allowed to have yet. There's 3 minutes on the 25th at their board meeting on the 25th in this very room to argue about making sure that they don't, when they're starting to make decisions, they spend an hour and a half, maybe an hour, talking about hybrid buses versus conventional buses. And the millage didn't include costing for the hybrid buses, so they can't afford the hybrid buses. And so they spent an hour arguing about that and 30 minutes arguing about the civil rights stuff. And so here we're already having.
Are you frustrated?
So if there's not enough money, there's on the one hand, in May, we had lots of work where everybody worked together to have the transit millage passed. And there's already this fracture. There's now, it went from having hundreds of people involved with the transit millage, and there are, you know, five people that show up at the board meetings of the transit agency to monitor that. So I'm just concerned that we need to find ways that the environmental community and the economic justice community can talk and talk through some of these things and work together
on the right path is all I can say. I don't want to get into the details. In California, we brought a federal suit that worked that found that the Metropolitan Transit Agency was creating disparate racial effects in its transportation service by not recognizing the poor people are the main people in need of buses, and they wanted to build subways and trains to be like New York. And we won the argument that there had to be a split, there had to be a fair allocation of those resources. It's never over because there are class differences and socioeconomic differences, but the NAACP, some former NAACP lawyers brought the case, and the bus riders union did the organizing. Yeah, Peter.
Just one little correction. If you'd stayed longer in Michigan, you would know that your idol Jeffrey Sachs was born and bred in the state. Maybe you knew that, but I didn't hear you mention it.
Why should I mention? I didn't mention the chief executive of Oakland County. There's all kinds of people. All kinds of people I didn't mention.
I
think you need
people.
To work on Jeffrey Sachs if you can set up meetings. He is a smart person. He's made catastrophic mistakes, but like anyone in the upper circles, he rebounds quickly and is restored to his role as the chief expert. And he's preparing the documents for the UN climate talks. And they're not bad, but they do include nuclear. And I've written him a long letter, and maybe I can see him next week in New York. But he's the central architect of the document, which will be voted on or rejected.
Well, more substantively, I just wanted to say that as an economist, it's very clear to me and most of us in that profession that the most rational approach to this is a carbon tax.
Yes.
And it could be high, but you could also distribute it. You could give it back as the way Alaska does with oil resources. You could give it back on a per capita basis. Or you could use some of it to fund the future of Medicare, which is very much in doubt. There are some very good uses you could put that money to that would be appealing to people. But giving it back, especially so poor people who pay the tax, are net winners rather
rebate,
than net losers.
Yeah. Well, you could do that if we had a federal government minus the House of Representatives. So that won't happen yet. But the California approach taxes carbon, because we're reducing the amount of emissions that are allowable. And if you don't cooperate, then you have to spend your money reducing emissions somewhere else, like Michigan. So they don't like that. They did everything in their power the last year to prevent that law, which passed in 2006, from being expanded to the fossil fuel industry starting this January. They bought members of the legislature, and I'm not exaggerating, did all kinds of things to try to repeal it, and we won the fight. But you come away really bruised, and they don't stop. They try to figure out another approach, basically spending their money on television commercials or candidates to unravel this law. And that's why we have this alliance system. British Columbia has a carbon tax, 8% and going up. We like that because their economy is comparable to Southern California, and they haven't suffered the slightest regression by having a carbon tax. Quebec is another example. Everybody is trying to approach the key issue that you mentioned, knowing that they have to forget about the House of Representatives and maybe even the Senate for a long time. Maybe they have to forget about the president. In the meantime, you do have, I forgot to mention, I'm sorry because I was running so long, you have this, so let me run longer. You have these very important Obama regulations to reduce the allowable power generated from coal. And the coal industry is screaming about it, but I think they see the handwriting on the wall. Michigan is getting $10 or $15 billion for compliance with these regulations. The utilities have not yet gone mad and revolted against the president. Your job is to keep him in check and make him comply. They're already shutting down some coal plants, and they're facing serious problems, but they have this wind potential. I mean, Florida, nowhere. Texas, nowhere. Michigan, Great Lakes. I mean, the wind potential of certain regions is pretty fantastic. If you read this morning's New York Times, you see Germany is moving well beyond the California standard. That's why we're partnering with Germany. And it's because they're sinking these gigantic wind machines offshore and preparing for the end if they don't make it. And they're eliminating the nuclear option. So California and Germany are collaborating, and it would be, it's important to understand psychologically. Jerry Brown is a German. What did you think he was?
English.
Huh? A Cuban? No, you thought he was an Irish Catholic.
Yeah.
That's his father's side. That's the big spender, hail fellow well met. The mother's side is the stringent, severe, penny-pinching like my mom. And so they get the idea of being efficient. Just like some people disparage them for that, but we better get used to it, that efficiency is not so bad. And to have a carbon tax would drive these companies towards efficiency. If you reward waste and let them dump stuff everywhere they want, poison the lakes. I'd like to go out in Lake Erie, but I don't want to troll in a dead zone. So you're absolutely right. I left it out because I don't see it coming, and I'm always looking for ways to indirectly increase the price of the bad fossil fuel direction and decrease the price of the clean energy direction. Same thing, but tell me if you hear somebody's introducing a bill.
All right, another question. Speaking of that carbon tax, I wonder if you are familiar with the organization Citizens Climate Lobby. Citizens Climate Lobby is a national grassroots organization that is lobbying Congress for a revenue-neutral carbon tax.
Yes, I know about that group, and I know about those efforts, and they're great. You have to have a very long view because it's certainly not going to happen in the House.
Not before the election.
Huh?
Not before the election.
No.
Well, we have a chapter of it in Ann Arbor now, and we would love to have your support of our policy.
Is, you have some elections coming up, which I'm not commenting on, but you know what you have to do.
Tom, I followed you since the 1960s SGC. My name is John Rasmussen. I recently returned from the Amazon after 5 trips and 10-12 weeks in the Amazon. And one thing that I think could be added to the approach is if we begin to consider the impact of our food choices on the climate. And the more beef we eat, the more cattle that are raised, the more Amazon that's cleared to feed animals is against the solution. The more plant-based we are, the less hydrocarbons are going to go into the atmosphere and the less pollution and better climate control. What's your comment on that?
That's a personal choice that has been adopted by millions of people, and it's a contribution to the solution. One of the things I noticed in Michigan yesterday, I was talking to a little boy who's about 8, and he was showing me a worm. And this is slightly related to what you're saying. And I said, hey, man, put that worm down. You're going to kill him. What are you doing with that worm? And he said, I'm putting him in the organic composter. And when I was a kid, I shoveled coal. So he's putting the worm. I said, well, the worm's going to die in there. Why don't you set him free? Free the worm. I'm trying to be funny. He says, nah, the sun will get him anyway, he'd die. It's too hot. It's like 90 degrees. He's better off in the compound. So from the minds of children come ideas that would never have occurred to me when I was shoveling coal. How rapid it goes, I don't know. But philosophically, I think we won't reach what we have to do until we're in the zone where it's too late. And some people say it's too late already. I don't agree with that, because it will get worse. And as it gets worse, we are adaptive, and the war between us on the planet will grow. But the number of people who choose to adapt creatively will probably prevail, but not without immense suffering and loss of millions of lives. There's no question about that. I'll talk about that Wednesday when we talk about war. But I do think, like that kid, the kids get it. They don't have all the tools, but why did this little boy know so much about food? It's because his mom and dad grow food to eat. He lives in Detroit. He doesn't live in Somalia. He lives in Detroit. And they do it to eat. I went in a Whole Foods. Our Whole Foods is all white. I mean, they allow black people in, but we are segregated totally in racial terms in Los Angeles. You don't see any black people shopping at Whole Foods. So I'd never been in a non-white Whole Foods. So I wanted to see what the hell they were doing by the hospital over there in Detroit. And I see this big sign, we're Whole Foods, we're based in Detroit, and we're proud of it. Big murals of people farming, big signs, like support Michigan farmers. I walk in, look around, and half the shoppers are black, half the shoppers are white. I've never seen that in my life, ever, anywhere. And the people working there, black and white. The whites are young. So I'm looking for something for my stomach. I go up to this guy. He's got dreads. He's got a hat like Al's. He's can I help you? I said, yeah, I need something like a Pepto-Bismol. I got a real problem in my gut, man. He starts this whole lecture about the probiotic drink that I should obtain, and that I should supplement that with this other drink. And he's like, the village organic pharmacist. he seems to know everything. He doesn't fit any stereotype of anything. But, you know, he's there, and I'm not. I'm thinking to myself, I'm not where he is. I need to learn more about what's going on here. And then I talked to some other people, the people that grow, about the struggles they're involved in, where you can be very supportive if you're not, where they have to, like, bargain with Whole Foods and bargain with outlets to take their stuff. They grow their peppers, they grow good stuff in their garden, and they have to market it. And they're not like the UAW. I wish they were like the UAW, and it was 1937, 1,000 organic farms in Detroit started marching towards the supermarket, demanding their access. But that might happen, and it seems to be happening. That's an example of we're in a transition that we don't understand we're in. It's happening so rapidly, it's difficult to, like, what you're doing. Were you doing this when you were a kid?
Started late, but the greening
it's
of
Detroit.
It's not
late. It's just, yeah. I was just asking when you started.
Late in life.
Yeah. Late in life, well, yep. No surprise.
Yeah. One point, of Detroit.
Yeah. I think the hook
we need
is coming.
We want to give some other people just like one, two more questions, if we can kind of make them quick, and then we'll do the book signing.
Okay.
Okay.
The drug war might relate to the ecological situation largely just because it's been such a huge distraction of attention for so long, but I want to comment on the cost of college. The college used to be supported, and now that money has gone someplace else to support another institution called prison. I think that is where the money has gone. And I would really like your comment, your really deep wisdom about the drug war. We know that these various drugs can be handled as a public health problem if they wanted to. Is the drug war really about drugs, or is it about setting up this massive system of repression for society?
I wouldn't impute motive to it because there's any war starts with multiple agendas. But I would say, obviously, we need a peace movement against the drug war. And I try to keep my perspective on the cost and the amount of dead people and the amount of people incarcerated and try to ask audiences to compare that to what they think are the benefits. And I think there's a consensus now that it's run its course, but with any war, it gets worse at the end. There could be something terrible, but you can feel it turning around. And the damage has been done, and we're in damage control. There's no reversing it. I think the telling argument for most people, most middle-of-the-road voters, is whether it's worked or not and what you're going to replace it with, and then you've sold them. So it's a case where the gradualism is too much for anybody to tolerate if they have loved ones in jail. But the gradualism is the most we've been able to accomplish with all our effort, and you should not feel badly about knowing where you stand and that you've done your best, and it's coming to the end. And we need to really watch what happens in certain states, Colorado and Washington, of course. We need to watch what's happening in Central America and Latin America, led by Uruguay. An old Tupamaro revolutionary is the president of Uruguay, and he's declared it a marijuana republic. And he learned that he had to back up because the middle class wasn't down with that. But he's legalized it, and it's in production. And that'll be copied by other countries. If Mexico had a more democratic government, they would have eliminated the drug war years ago. But it's on our southern rim. And it's very important to realize the connection between the drug war and U.S. military intervention and corporate and banking intervention in Central and Latin America, which is my borderland. They use the drug war for multiple purposes. One, to scare people about drug dealers coming over. But the underlying reason is it gives them a way to militarize the border. They call it a rim of steel, to protect against left-wing insurgencies, especially those that are elected to office, who have power. And gradually it's turning. It's just amazing to me that our president and vice president, who know all about this, are so gradual and so hesitant to do what they know they should do on the grounds that they can't. And I'm a politician, so I trust their judgment, but it terrifies me that they make this judgment, because if they're right, we are really in a hell of a problem. Because their idea of extricating from the drug war is so slow, so fraught, that it'll be beyond the lifetime of my 14-year-old boy before it really ends. So it doesn't surprise me that Iraq is not over either. People try to end it, but they don't really deal with it, so it goes on. So I connect it in that way. I ask people whether marijuana would be a boon to the Michigan economy. I leave that to you. It's very, very good for California's economy. I met a student today from Humboldt who knows what I'm talking about. I'll leave her name out of the discussion. But I think the economic benefits of growing marijuana, the safety benefits of regulating it, the tax benefits of taxing it, the health benefits of reducing violence and steering it into a carefully regulated distribution program, on balance, far outweigh whatever benefit the war model once had, which I don't think it had anything. But I think people are ready in our state to agree to that. It's amazing how slowly they've come to it. Anybody else? Yes.
Yes. First, I'd like to thank you for coming. I'm delighted to be here. My name's Jeffrey Bronze-Eagle. I'm Choctaw and Creek. And given all of the debate over immigration, I'm personally concerned, and I'm sure many others are, about the indigenous people of, say, the Pacific Islands and all of the other low-lying areas with the increasing elevation of the sea. These people are going to become displaced if we continue on this course, and I'm just wondering which countries are going to relocate them in their countries. Is that possibly going to be on the agenda next year?
Yes, I'm sure it is, because Bolivia chairs this group of 79 plus China. So the drug war, the other issues that are not on our agenda are very much on the agenda in that conference in Lima, and I'm not sure the West is going to be able to get through that gate. Everything may have to fall apart again. But yes, that's a big issue. My wife is descendant from native Oglala, and her family went from this country, went from this country, the Dakotas, to Canada on the run from the American Army, and then they migrated eventually to British Columbia, where her father was a logger. And we've retraced that immigrant trail a very, very long time. And I think in Canada, the tribal groups are not all powerful, but they're called First Nations, of course, and they will have a big effect also as a voice in alliance with other voices at these summits. And you're right. I mean, I didn't mention it, but they face the worst of the storm and had the least to do with it. Nobody should be caught in shame about that. They should just do something about that. Pay attention to it. Yes.
That is it. It's our last question that you just answered. Oh.